I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Welcome to Sick Boy, a podcast where we talk about what it's like to be sick. This week's guest is Judith John. She was the former vice president of communications at Sick Kids in Toronto, and she had a brain tumor. Let's talk about it. A little more
gorilla style.
I'm really glad you asked me. I was surprised.
Yeah. Yeah. So why don't you introduce yourself? I mean, we're here talking about like politics and and the state of the world. But before we get too deep into all of that, why don't you let our listeners know who you are?
Okay. My name is Judith John. I worked for many years in healthcare and communications and loved it. I love healthcare because they were the smartest, most dedicated, wonderful colleagues I could have asked for. And unfortunately for me, I was diagnosed with a brain tumor. The good news was after the doctor said the brain tumor is inoperable, he did say it was benign. But because of that and because of 5 years of kinds of treatments and trying to figure out what to do, I had to step down from my position at SickKids. I'd previously been at Mount Sinai. And because of all that, I think I learned a lot about healthcare from both perspectives, from being a healthcare executive to being a patient in a blue gown, the universal symbol of being impotent.
What did you do in the healthcare world? What, like, so you say you worked at SickKids. In what capacity?
I was in communications, so I headed up communications for those hospitals. So I have no clinical ability and no research ability, but I got to work and talk about and deal with issues and learn about all those areas.
So we have listeners. A lot of our listeners are Canadian. And so I'm guessing when the word SickKids gets dropped, a lot of Canadians can recognize that that is a pretty like predominant hospital here in Toronto. For people who aren't really aware of what SickKids is and what it's all about, do you want to just kind of fill them in?
Oh, sure. SickKids is one of the top five children's hospitals in the world, and it is a combination of research, education, and unbelievable clinical care. So children from across Canada, from around the world, come to SickKids. And SickKids develops programs that go to places like Africa or the Caribbean to help with healthcare as well.
They also have one of the most badass commercials I think I've ever seen in my life. You know what I'm talking about, Tay?
I actually haven't seen it yet.
You haven't seen it?
Did Tori work on that? Tori that we did our training with?
Maybe in some capacity. I feel like I saw her post something about
that. Yeah, I know. I saw something where they were all in gowns and
It's like each kid has like their own superpower.
SickKids versus.
Yeah.
And it's very different from the usual SickKids kind of commercial, or any commercial for a children's hospital, is very emotional, you know, and it tugs on all the heartstrings. This one says, you know what? We're going to beat this. And don't feel sorry for us because we're winning and we're empowered. And, I mean, there's been a lot of controversy around it, and I think it was a very brave and bold campaign.
I do, too.
Yeah. So, I got goosebumps.
Yeah, no good idea doesn't go without controversy.
So, I think one of the reasons why I felt so like, amped up about it is that so I live with cystic fibrosis, and that's where this whole podcast, you know, basically started from, was like sitting down with as the three of us and chatting about my experience in living with CF.
Right.
And doing work with CF Canada over the years and talking to them and, you know, Sick Boy, we've done plenty of work with CF Canada since we started. I remember one of the things that I felt so strongly about in terms of like the way that CF Canada would promote awareness is they really would like heavily rely on the tugging on the heartstrings, mm-hmm. and like really emotional ads of like children like drowning in their own lungs kind of thing. I mean, even just saying that.
Like SPCA type ads?
Yeah. Like Sarah McLachlan in the background singing while you're seeing these like, you know, really like sad, sick children. And you know, I'm sure that that plays a really big role in bringing in funds and like that's one way of doing it. But I don't think that's the way. Like I don't feel like maybe it was at some time, but I feel like we're moving beyond that. I think we're getting into a point in time where people see that shit and they go, oh, I can't. Like, I can't deal with this.
It also strikes me as something that I've seen on TV 1,000 times since the time that I remember watching TV. And I feel like I'm sure it worked, like you said, I'm sure it worked because they kept going with
it. They do it.
And you probably get comfortable with it. As somebody who runs a business and does advertising campaigns, when something works, you tend to really want to stick with it. And it becomes frightening to move away from it because you know that it works and you don't want it. And it gets harder to take a chance on something new and to create something that's, you know, a little bit more alternative. But it's very much in line. And I have seen some of the ad and I remember seeing something around it and something that Sick Kids did. It's very brave. I think you said
I think it's
brave
very
and
brave
courageous.
And I think it cut through. I mean, the problem is it's quite predictable in any healthcare situation, in any, you know, heartwarming charity that's where you're going to go. And here they said it's more about empowerment. Mm. If you help us, we can empower these kids. I was shocked when I worked at Sick Kids. People would say, oh, it must be so depressing to be with all those children who are so ill. And in fact, it's very uplifting because the kids are fantastic. The care is superb. And there is a kind of attitude that together we're going to deal with this.
Yeah.
And I found the kids very, very brave. I know some of the children who were featured in that campaign. And for them, it was a way of saying, don't feel sorry for us. Encourage us, but don't feel sorry for us. We're going to do this.
I mean, we've had similar kind of sentiments thrown our way in terms of people going, yo, do you ever leave the conversations that you guys have on the podcast and think, oh, man, that was hard? Or do you leave feeling sad or heavy? And it's like, no, man, we leave these conversations feeling so light and open because we just got to be vulnerable and share our experiences and dive into something that someone might have been wanting to offload for X amount of time, but haven't had like the opportunity or the platform to do so. And whenever we leave, that yes, sure, the content might go into a heavy place, but we try to navigate it in a light way, and we come out feeling happier and better.
But I think that's our. I think that is Sick Boy's kind of like, you know, like tone. Like we set this very like light, like, oh, we're going to talk about terminal cancer. Woohoo! You know,
well,
like
you have a chronic condition that will kill you in the end.
Yeah, exactly. And so, but we approach it that way. And that's, and of course we're going to leave the conversations feeling like that. But the interesting thing about children and children's hospitals is like, you know, kids deal with traumatic, you know, circumstances and sadness and grief and things like that way differently than adults do. You know, you go into an adult hospital, that's where I feel like it would be really hard not to take work home with you. Whereas you work at a children's hospital, children want to inherently just play.
But also,
you know, and have like enjoy their childhood, even though they might be terminal or, you know.
But when Brandon was talking about our friend Brandon has an osteosarcoma or had an osteosarcoma, and he was diagnosed at 19 or 20 years old.
19. And diagnosed at 18, and I think he had surgery at 19.
So he was treated in the Children's Hospital in Halifax because it's a child cancer more commonly found in children. Mm-hmm. And later on in his journey, I guess, he ended up going and spending time at the adult hospital, and he said the difference between the two is so drastically more. It's way more depressing being at the adult hospital. Like the walls aren't colorful; they're just this pale yellow, and it's fluorescent lighting, and even the environment isn't.
And one of the issues we dealt with at SickKids is the transition from going from a children's hospital, which is so warm and enveloping and designed around children, and everybody there who works there self-selects to work with children, and then going to a much more elaborate or labyrinth of adult health care. It's a big problem.
I'll never forget when I went from the IWK CF clinic to the QE2 CF clinic.
Yeah.
I was like, what the fuck? Like, this is my life now? Like, is this actually, I have to go from that to that? Like,
isn't it so
interesting? No more face paint?
Isn't it so interesting that there is such a drastic change? It's like all of a sudden, you don't deserve all of these like colorful walls and like all this like really nice, like playful animation everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, you walk into IWK and you've got like Disney characters all over the walls and everything. And it's, and you're, what, like, and then it's just like, no, not anymore.
So that's for babies.
You are now 18. Yeah. Deal with it.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Yeah,
big
no
shift.
More, no more goofy. No Ju- more.
Judith, I'm interested to hear a little bit about your experience in finding out that you had a brain tumor. How did that happen?
I had lucky cancer. So here's the thing. I'm not a hypochondriac, but I'm like a complete tooth maniac. So I had a blister. I kept saying to my dentist, I think I've got gum disease. I think I've got this. I've got that. Nothing. And then finally,
Taylor's got a really bad blister right now.
Oh,
it's not a bad blister, but it's something in my mouth and it won't go away.
Well, here we go. Get it checked. Finally, literally to shut me up, they gave me a biopsy, and the dentist called me that afternoon and said, the good news is we can deal with this. The bad news is it's basal cell carcinoma. So that usually comes when you're a smoker. It's a skin cancer. It's the most treatable skin cancers you can get. I never smoked. It was just random bad luck. And the good news for me, and there is good news to this, is they took that out and it was fine, and they gave me a CT scan after that just to make sure. And again, the doctor said, good news is all the cancer's gone. Bad news is you have a tumor in your brain, and you better get it checked. So I would not have found out about it until I'd actually had a stroke, because the tumor, not malignant, is wrapped around my carotid arteries, and it was pressing on my optic nerve. So I always say I had lucky cancer. People think I'm crazy, but if that hadn't happened, I would have been.
So wait, you're the tumor in your brain, the benign tumor in your brain, caused the skin cancer?
Nothing to do with
it. They were totally unrelated.
Totally unrelated.
Whoa.
But it was only in checking for the cancer that it was removed that they said, oh, this is good, but look at that.
Wow.
it's a big growing tumor. So I was actually diagnosed 20 years ago with that.
And they
took out the tumor at that point through my nose. It's called transfrenoidal.
It's like the ultimate booger.
Yeah. I hadn't thought of that. I might use that. It's true. And it came out, and when I was sure I was going to die. I never heard of this before. And, you know, and I'm busy. Yeah. And there were 6 weeks between the time I was told I was going to go in for surgery and the surgery was set. And in that time, you know, I was super productive at work. I was working at United Way at the time, and I was fabulous. And I made jokes about, you know, nobody make any things and say it's brainless or, you know, this is.
Right.
So,
right.
And then I wrote letters to my kids all night. I cleaned out my drawers so that when my husband's second wife came, she would think I had a lot of stuff.
God.
But I was really neat. I was manic. And then I survived the surgery, which was great. And the doctor said we got almost all the tumor out.
Was it a risky surgery?
Yeah, but not as risky as going in through your brain.
Right.
It's a new technology, and they actually stick stuff up, I guess.
Crazy.
Isn't that fucking wild?
Oh, like, it's wild.
They're going, there's a thing in your brain, so we're just going to shove some crap up your nose.
And pull it out. Bit by bit. It was a long surgery. At the end of it, the doctor said there was one particle that was embedded in your brain wall. It would be dangerous to try to get it, but really the chances of this growing again are like 1 in 5 million. So
that's pretty good.
That was the lottery I won.
So you're telling me there's a chance.
There's a chance, and it happened 5 years later.
Get the fuck out of here.
Oh, no. 5 years later.
Oh, my God, Judith.
The tumor
I'm so
had
sorry.
Grown. No, that's all right. I said I would have rather to, you know, a Winteria win, not a Winteria win.
Yeah.
So then it had moved to the other side of my brain. And so they couldn't go through the nose again. And at the time, the pituitary surgeon said, we're going to have to take this out eventually. And I said, why don't we plan it now? I'm younger than I'll be tomorrow. I can get my work organized, blah, blah, blah. And he said, we never go into the brain unless we have to.
Mm.
And we'll know when this needs to be dealt with. So, you know, I was making a presentation at SickKids about budget. I had a massive headache. I was kind of pale green. And
I would be, too, if I was talking about budgets.
Budget was ugly. Ugly is not like that. I'm a word person, not a number person. Anyway, so I'm making this, and all of a sudden I started seeing double. I couldn't read the chart because I was seeing two levels of numbers. And fortunately for me, I think I got the budget. But because I worked at SickKids, the head of pediatrics said, something has happened. One of my eyelids had drooped. And he said, I'm taking you down to ophthalmology. So we went down to the eye clinic, and I sat in a chair, and they sort of squeezed my face into the equipment. And then the doctor said, this is really exciting. I haven't seen adult eyes in 10 years.
Oh.
And there was mass. And it was the tumor had grown and exploded and hemorrhaged in my brain.
Whoa.
So, yeah. So.
You like literally exploded.
Literally
like, not
exploded. It
exploded in size, but it blew up.
It blew up.
So you're bleeding. Like it hemorrhages in. You're now bleeding in
I'm
your brain.
I'm bleeding in my brain. So go over to Western Hospital.
This sounds bad.
It was very bad. And I remember my daughter drove me over to the hospital. And we were waiting in Emerge, and they did, you know, they did the MRI, and then we waited. And at about 3:30 in the morning, to keep ourselves going, we were writing out names of dogs when we got our next puppy. And for some reason, at 3:20, we were convulsed in laughter over the name Harriet for a dog. Don't ask me why. But they came back and said, we're going to operate and get this out. And so they did what's called a craniotomy when they cut your head in a kind of melon shape and peel back the skin and go in and try to get the tumor.
Yes.
So it was, the next day it was 12-hour surgery. Again, I'm sure I'm gone. I'm thinking I've lived a good life and I have these wonderful kids and, you know, the cupboards aren't as clean this time because I didn't know. I was going to have surgery. And they were able, the doctor was fabulous and able to get all the blood, like all the blood clot was removed, but it couldn't get the tumor. And it is right in the worst part of my brain.
So I mean, where is it? Like I'm looking
at
it.
It's right behind my nose and right in the center. So everything is engaged with it. Like, you know, so if you tried to do surgery, I would probably have a stroke. If you tried to do surgery, I could go blind. If you tried to do surgery, it is a benign tumor, but the issue is how it grows.
Right.
So will it continue to grow? Like
I'm hoping not. Now, what they've done, for 5 years, you would have loved me. I wore a patch because I had double vision.
Mm.
And we were waiting to see the growth of the tumor. And Canada's very much a wait and see, first do no harm kind of medical culture. If I'd been in the States, they would have gone in and operated and at great risk. And at great expense.
Show me the money.
Yeah. Is that because they're getting paid to do that?
I think it's a bit of both.
It's a bit of,
I'm
sure it's a bit
I think
of
it's a bit of the American mentality, like, deal with this, get it out, I can't live with this. Well, I could live with it, and I had to learn to live with it. And, you know, dealing with, you know, double vision can kind of be fun. I mean, if I went to the Canada Day fireworks, I just took off my patch and I saw, it was like LSD. I saw triple the fireworks. Nice. Or I was at a cottage and we were watching constellations and I just
Judith
took my glasses.
Run around the fucking field like, woo! Like, what's going on? What's mom doing?
And then you have a
she took
glasses.
Her glasses off.
Yeah.
You have a couple
Put
glasses of wine, and then it's even more.
It's even better. Yeah. We were at this cottage, and I took off my glasses, my patch to swim, and made everybody laugh because I went on the dock, and I was going up the steps, except I was using the shadow ladder, which wasn't real. So I learned to live with that, and then eventually the tumor was growing again, and it was going to be dangerous. And so we did 6 weeks of radiation.
Oh, wow.
So I had radiation every day at Princess Margaret, and I would sit in the waiting room and realize I don't have cancer. And you'd look at people, and I'm a communications person. I write stories about people all the time. I sit on the subway and imagine what you're really like and what's really happened. And so I had a field day with all the people getting radiation at Princess Margaret. And that, now that I've had that, we are hoping it will contain things.
Mm, great.
So it wasn't to shrink the tumor. I still have chronic pain. I still have, you know, issues that my eyes get tired and I can, you know, get double vision. But basically I manage and it's fine. And what was interesting is while I was obsessed by cancer, having sat there 6 weeks every day, my husband had a lump on his neck and I would say, you should get that checked, you should get that checked. Well, my husband is British and a man and it's nothing, it's nothing, it's nothing. And you know,
he says it so elegantly.
Yeah, does he have an accent?
Yeah, he does a bit. He's Welsh, but he's lived here most of his time. So he would think maybe he's from South Africa.
Right.
Nobody really knows where he's from. Neither does he. So finally, I wore him down, and he got it checked, and he was diagnosed with tongue cancer. Instantly. So we had this cool radiation
he's
relay.
Like the perfect couple.
I finished, and he started, and my daughter, who was planning her wedding, said, "We'll postpone the wedding." I said, "You will not postpone the wedding." And I'm such an A-type. I said, "Michael's radiation and chemo will be done on this date. That gives him 3 weeks. He'll still have a feeding tube, but we can go to the wedding." And she said, "You can't even keep food down," because I was in the midst of radiation. I said, "I'll be able to buy a very skinny Mother of the Bride dress."
There you go.
before you go any further there, for a lot of people that we've spoken to and a lot of people that I've known, and I've done a lot of work with this organization called Athletes for Cancer. I spend a lot of time with people with cancer.
Yeah.
It's not an easy thing to go through.
Not at all.
It's horrible. Really, really horrible, really tough. There's a lot of like heaviness and a lot of sadness. And I know that this is all, most of this is kind of in retrospect, but to hear you sit here and talk about this, it sounds like the experience, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like the experience was very matter of fact.
I wouldn't say matter of fact, but I was deeply grateful all the way through.
Okay.
I knew we were getting great care, and I know everybody has something to deal with.
Yeah.
Like, I had this gilded life, and I never said, gee, why is my career going so well, or why do I have these two fabulous children? So that when things don't go well, people say, oh, why me? Well, why not you?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah. So another thing that I've run into, and it's kind of the opposite of this, it's people who have, like in your case, the good cancer, or the cancer that like is just, it's nowhere near as bad as like Tom and Jane's cancer.
Yep.
And they go through this like weird sort of like
guilt.
Sufferer's guilt.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Where they feel like, well,
mom felt that way.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And it makes sense to me. It makes sense why someone would feel that. You know what I mean? It's that we all experience things differently. We all have our own shit, right?
Yes.
And so, your shit might make you feel a certain way and you might come down on yourself for it. But then when you see yourself looking at someone who's way worse off, in quotations, compared to you, then you feel guilty that you even for a second like were being mopey about your own situation.
You know, cancer's like a cloak that you always wear. So every time I'm not feeling great or I have a massive headache, I think, oh my God. You know, it can always come back. It's always part of your existence. But there was and I don't think attitude changes the outcome, but it changes how you get through it. I mean, I get mad when people say, you're strong, you'll get through this, and your attitude's positive. Well, are you saying people who don't get through it, it's because they're stressed?
They're not strong?
Yeah, they're not stressed. I hate that. That was something that we dealt with. We have a good sense of humor as a family. Like, people were shocked at how hilariously funny we were in the midst of this. I was going through this, my husband's going through this, and my daughter said, well, you are getting to be high maintenance parents.
You know? Yeah.
And it was perfect because you have to. I made a choice when I was first diagnosed. I didn't want to lie on a couch and be one of those Victorian mothers who was poorly, you know, and I couldn't work, but I could volunteer. And I drifted into this patient advocacy stuff quite by accident. And I thought, you know, that makes sense. Because when we were executives sitting around the table developing metrics at SickKids, you know, how many kids come into the emergency and how fast will we see them and how fast will we diagnose them? Will they be back? Blah, blah, blah. You put on the gown. And the what really matters as a patient is the metric, treat me like a person.
Mm-hmm.
Don't treat me
wow.
like a cool bunch of symptoms or a file name. I mean, I was waiting for my MRI once at the hospital, and you know, the administrator comes out and says, brain tumor. And I was shocked.
Whoa, that's pretty wild.
It was wild. And yeah. I thought, my name is Judith John, brain tumor. Not even more syllables, not hard to pronounce.
Yeah.
But it was, you're just diminished all the time. And I fought back a lot with that when I was being treated because, you know, I have a sense of humor and I speak the language and I know who to call and I know how to respond. Mm. I thought a lot about the people who don't speak the language and are new to Canadian healthcare and don't have access to that. And it's like a forest.
I'm guessing you never went through that sufferer's guilt.
I sure did a bit yeah. with a friend who had, I have a wonderful friend who was diagnosed with a malignant brain tumor about 2 years into my treatment. And I would take him to rehab. And his was he died from it. It was a horrible, he was younger, he had younger kids. And as I was taking him, I said, I feel so bad because I have this tumor, which isn't pleasant and will end my life probably, but I'm not dying from it. And I said, why did you have to one-up me on this? And, but of course you do, because I know how lucky I've been. You know, we've both been lucky.
Yeah, but I love that you took on that sort of attitude. It's
I wanted to I know we were talking about this before we hit record, or maybe it was in the beginning before we kind of dove into things about that you are an American transplant to Canada, originally from Pennsylvania.
That's right.
And you've renounced your American citizenship.
I have.
For a sole Canadianity. And you said that you were you saying that you did some research into what kind of the estimate cost of what your care would have been if you had opted for your US path of, because this is something I'm really fascinated in, as I was saying before, is the differences in the US system of healthcare versus the Canadian system.
The U.S. system, you can get excellent health care, of course.
Yeah.
If you look at the stats internationally, it's about 11th from the bottom, really, because most people can't get that level of health care.
Right.
Wow. But I was looking at the cost, the specific cost of, if I were to move back to the States, what would it cost me with a pre-existing condition to buy insurance?
Which is the big like hot button buzzword right now in American healthcare.
And I renounced before it was the big hot button. I renounced when the very flawed but well-meaning and good start Obamacare was there.
Right. You got to start somewhere.
You do. And it's appalling that of all the advanced nations in the world, it's only the U.S. that doesn't give universal health care. It's disgusting, I think. And the cost that when I was looking into it, and it was about 3-4 years ago, before this horrible situation in the States now, it was astronomical. And I had to ask myself, is it something that I'll ever do, move back to the States?
Yeah.
And, you know, I was only glad in the last election, because I was from Pennsylvania and I had renounced by then, that Hillary didn't lose by one vote. Because I would have thought it was my vote and I would have felt really sad.
What was the number? Do you
ballpark?
What was the ballpark number?
Oh, gosh, I can't remember, but it was thousands and thousands. I can't remember.
That's
but
okay.
It was enough to make me go, this doesn't make sense.
Enough to make you squeezy?
Yeah, I think that no healthcare system is perfect. We know that. And this, ours is going through some of its growing pains of its own. But it's part of the Canadian psyche. One of the reasons I'm so proud to be a Canadian is that we are universal in how we want to care for people. I mean, it's, again, not perfect, but healthcare is a defining factor in being Canadian.
The thing that I find really interesting about American mentality is that, like, as soon as you cross the border, if you're like, we often drive from Halifax down to like New York, for example, and we pass into Maine, and it's almost immediate that you start to see American flags hanging off every porch and doorstep.
It's a very different mentality.
But they're so
patriotism, I should
say. They're so patriotic. And to me, patriotic is standing up for your fellow countrymen.
Yeah.
Yet one of the reasons I tend to hear for people not wanting to have universal health care is that they don't want to pay for something that isn't benefiting them.
Well, it's free market as well. I mean, the big, there's free market capitalism is a huge aspect of like American culture. And I think that it kind of goes back to, I just lost my train of thought. Hold on one sec. It's coming.
Free market capitalism goes back to
in three.
No, no, don't speak.
Two.
I'm not gonna get it if you talk.
Zero.
I'll just make my. Sure. I'll add my. We'll go back up.
One.
And
two.
Okay.
Three.
So anyway, sucked in that. But like I personally lend myself more towards like a communist mentality where I would just want equal for everyone.
You and fucking commie. Don't even bring that in here. And listen, don't even bring that into this room.
Listen,
Brian.
I know,
dare you?
In like. An ideal world, if it worked, that would be great. And I know from history, historically, that communism doesn't work. So I understand, but like that's
and
the
we're learning democracy. You mean
communism from the root word of community?
Yes, exactly.
You don't mean communism in the way of what we know historically.
Masking communism. Yeah. No. Yeah. So I like to think that it would be great if everybody could have everything equal. But in the States, coming from that more like patriotic mentality where we are winners and we put ourselves first, I would just think that even from that mentality, you would be able to say, yes, we put ourselves first, but we put all of our countrymen first. So our countrymen and countrywomen are country people. We put
country people.
Country folk
first. So then we should care for them.
Gotta be neutral, Bri.
We should offer them up universal health care because we should care for them.
Well, I got my train of thought back, which was what you said about the, you know, if you actually look at where America is in the healthcare on the totem pole, they're actually very close to the bottom because there is the top of the top of the top of healthcare available in quotations. Like what we in the healthcare debate right now, it's like we're trying to make it more accessible. Everybody has, and this, I think someone made this argument in the House when it was going on, is that, well, technically everybody has access to buy a Ferrari, but if not everybody has the money to afford the access.
Yeah.
So access and affordability are two very different things. But in this free market system that really prizes, you know, make it on your own, do it yourself, like rags to riches type of idea, that, you know, it's there for you if you've done the work to afford it when you get sick.
And the irony of the whole thing in the States, we're going to go off track here, is it's now the division between those who have and those who haven't, which changed the election, which made people feel alienated. It's the same thing that happened in Britain. People feel they don't have a chance and they can't get there. And I don't understand with healthcare that there's this lack of understanding that if you give people a basic level of care, you'll have a healthier society. You will have more opportunity. And they understand paying for car insurance. I don't understand why nobody there gets you pay for health insurance.
Yeah. Mm. I don't think capitalism is evil and I don't think a free market system is a bad thing. But there are certain things that should just be excluded from that mentality. And I think healthcare is one of them. We should all just be able to be healthy. And I know the cost is ridiculous and it's astronomical.
The cost of sick people is really high though.
So when I looked at the meds that I take, dude, did I tell you guys this about how much
we saw it in the doc.
Isn't that crazy? So a bottle, that bottle right over there of Creon enzymes, I go through one bottle every 5 days. I take about 7 pills every time I eat a meal.
Right.
That bottle in the US costs over $500 for that bottle. I get
boxes, flats of them.
Hordes of them every month for free.
Yeah.
And
you said it was 10 grand for the box.
Yeah, probably
10 grand for the box
so
that you
Judith,
opened up.
I think that your numbers are probably even more
from the amount of pills that I had. Yeah.
So what were your numbers for that you estimated for care if you were living in the States?
I know, for example, I mean, I'm a frequent flyer of the healthcare system. I thank everybody. You know, I get two MRIs a year. So an MRI in the States is, I think it's well into the, you know, tens of thousands.
Oh, my Whoa. God. What?
Oh, yeah, no, it's, I mean, and I was in an emergency department for a couple weeks ago for a whole different thing. And we estimated it would have been a $65,000, $70,000 trip if I'd been in the States for all the tests that they gave. So it does, And what it does is it changes people's ability to say, I better get this checked out.
Mm.
And if you get it checked out, sometimes that's the best thing to do, and you can get it treated then.
Hi, I'm Jessie Cruikshank.
Jessie Cruikshank.
I host the number one comedy podcast called Phone a Friend.
Girl, let's phone a friend.
Not only do I break down the biggest stories in pop culture with guests like Dan Levy and members of NSYNC, I do it with my own personal boy band singing jingles throughout. Because it's my show.
It's your show, girl.
New episodes of Phone a Friend.
Yeah.
Drop Thursdays wherever you get your podcasts.
So work it, girl. Yeah, work it.
Okay, that's enough.
You guys ever see John Q?
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. With the Denzel. Yeah.
If anybody who's listening, if you haven't seen John Q, it is an incredible movie. Basic plot line. Denzel Washington's son, has like an abrupt heart failure and he has to get a transplant, but they're like a low to middle class family.
Yeah.
And it's like $250,000 for the transplant and they just don't have it. And the hospital basically says, sorry, you don't have money, so we don't do that. And
he takes the hospital hostage. Not the way to do it. Don't do it that way. However, I also do want to just say, I know that we have a lot of American listeners, and by no means are we sitting here and like, you know, just like shitting on your mentality. But for four Canadian people, we see the world very differently than the majority of the people that live below us, right? And so it's just hard for us to wrap our head around.
I'm happy to give some of my income so that looking out this window right now, that woman driving by in that Toyota Camry can go to the hospital and get some tests done and not go house broke.
I'm one of those people that actually says, I believe in taxes. Like if taxes can make my community safer and better schools and better libraries and better healthcare and better transit, like I will pay it willingly because I'm part of a society.
Is that why I can get those bottles of pills for free in Nova Scotia? Because of the taxes that Nova Scotia pays?
Dude, that's why when we go to the emergency room, that's why when anybody does anything, we don't pay for it. Because when you get paid every 2 weeks, there's a deduction and that goes towards healthcare, and same with everybody in the country.
And what I felt all the way through is, yes, we were facing these life-threatening situations, and that, no matter how you gloss over it, no matter how witty and optimistic you are, it's frightening. But I wasn't frightened we'd lose our house.
Mm.
And I think to add the financial burden to the emotional burden to the health burden,
God, I can't even imagine,
is monstrous.
Mm-hmm. I do want to come back to your daughter's wedding.
Yeah, like, it was great.
The two like stubborn parents who really probably shouldn't be, like, the wedding probably should have been postponed. I don't know, but it sounds like it should have been. But you said no. We're going through with this. And you went? You guys
we
ended up going?
We had the best wedding. I mean, she had the best wedding.
Yeah.
We had the best time. My sisters from the States were just appalled and said, you're crazy. You've got to cancel this. You're not well.
It was best wedding.
It was a great wedding.
And my
dress was gorgeous, by the way. I don't know if I'll ever wear it again, but it was great. And we had sunshine. And it was a kind of affirmation wedding in every way. Like, people who hadn't seen us were sure we would come with wheelchairs.
Yeah.
And then we were there, and we had a good time. We had a great time. And there was this added level of joy because we'd gotten through being in radiation literally all spring. And we were going to be healthy. I mean, my husband still had a feeding tube, but he wore a suit, so it didn't show. And clearly there was a long road ahead for him. But, you know, life is full of ups and downs and everything else. But if you can hang on to something joyous and meaningful like that, I'm sure it was a catalyst for us to say, we're going to get through this.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know what? Like, I totally believe in the power of positive thinking and like positive experience and, you know, like laughter being a major form of therapy in my life. Like, I'm sure that wedding just helped drive you and your, in particular, your husband.
Yep.
Towards that healthier life.
And it was really fun. Like, she was never Bridezilla, you know.
Oh,
it
great.
Worked out that it was
Isn't
and
that
it was
the worst.
the worst.
Man,
the
man. Worst. So crazy.
And, you know, different cultures and kids running around. It was great.
That's sweet.
So, yeah.
How's your husband doing?
He's good.
Yeah?
He's good. He's, you know, he got very good last scan. Most of his taste buds have come back. It was ironic that he got tongue cancer because he's the cook in the family. Food really matters to him.
Mm.
And in fact, while he was going through chemo and was vile and a feeding tube, he would go to bed at night and read cookbooks. And I'd say, you are a masochist.
Oh, my God. It's torture.
Weird. It was weird. But I, on the other hand, couldn't look at food as if I never ate again when I was going through treatment. It would be fine.
Yeah.
I just couldn't. But he's cooking again. He's baking again. He's, you know, he's very comfortable with his life.
Yeah. Do you guys find that hard when you're, like, starving and someone's like, oh, let's watch this cooking show? I'm always like, absolutely not.
Starving?
I'm
I don't really watch cooking shows
Me
in
neither.
General, but, yeah, I mean, I'm one of those people that, in that same, not from chemo cause I haven't gone through it, but when I'm like crazy, crazy full, my mentality is I'd be happy to never eat again.
Oh. Yeah, me too.
Isn't it crazy how you can just not be able to think about the future?
And then you do it again and you think, wait a minute, I said last time I wasn't going to eat to this point.
Yeah. I know.
For me, yeah, like smells. How many times have you had pancakes? I love pancakes. Every time I eat pancakes, when I'm done, I go, I think I'm done.
Can you make that
pancakes?
Sound one more time?
I think I'm done with pancakes for the rest of my life.
You should have stopped 4 pancakes ago.
Yeah. Dude, no.
I watched you eat pancakes about an hour ago.
I know.
And?
I'll never have them again, and I'll probably have them tomorrow.
Yeah.
I can't do smells when I'm hungry.
Yeah.
Smells are what like really drives me over the edge. I go crazy.
I
want to take my face off.
Yeah.
Smells are hard when you're going through radiation, chemo, and stuff. Like everything is
really
assault.
Pungent. Yeah.
What was the recovery like for the nose, the ultimate booger surgery?
That was pretty quick.
Yeah.
Compared to I'll tell you a funny story. The nose thing was fairly quick. I think it was 6 weeks or something. The craniotomy was a lot more invasive.
No doubt.
No doubt. And it was interesting because we had been planning a 65th anniversary wedding surprise for my parents in Pennsylvania. And it was literally 2 weeks after I had the surgery. And I was determined to get there. And I remember talking to the doctor and said, I'd like to go to Pennsylvania for this. And he said, oh, okay, when? And I said, 2 weeks from now. And he said, you got to be kidding. And I said, I asked if I was drugged up in the car and we drove there and I just took it easy. But I knew if I didn't go, my parents would think I was really deathly ill.
Mm.
So we did that. And I slept in the car. Everybody was shocked to see me. I looked as if I'd been in a terrible automobile accident because the whole side of my face was black and blue. It was really ugly. But I was there. And, you know, it turned out to be the best decision of my whole life because my father, who was in his element with all his family there, that was the last he was healthy. He was diagnosed with leukemia literally 2 months later. And so I always think I'm glad I forced myself into that party.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah.
What was it like or what has it been like? Because it sounds like you loved your job at SickKids.
I'd still be there. They'd have to drag me out.
Yeah. So what was that like, kind of being forced out of a job
Well,
that you
were,
loved?
Well, they were fantastic, and they waited a year. I mean, and we thought I would be back, and every test said you can't. So it was hard for me, but I stayed connected. So I do a lot of writing now for SickKids. I am on committees for SickKids. I worked on a history book for SickKids. So I don't do the formal job, but I'm active there. And that was for me the whole thing. My husband, who's very relaxed with his life, thinks that I'm crazy because I have all these interesting contracts. But I like being involved. And the patient care stuff is I'm on all kinds of committees for the government about how to improve the patient experience because, well, you've been in hospitals. Every hospital has a plaque that says, we are patient and family centered.
Mm.
And it's rhetoric, not reality.
Right.
And so we have to work on having people understand it's not just the children's hospitals who need to focus on their patients and their families.
Mm.
So that's been very gratifying. And so I'm involved in SickKids, though I miss it deeply.
What have you taken from the work that you've done with SickKids? Like, you know, it sounds like it's a very rewarding experience, a very rewarding place to work. What's like the biggest lessons you've taken from that place?
Oh, it's a very big question and a very true observation. It is a superb environment. I think people who go into healthcare are a special breed. I think that everybody I know had a mission and a vision of helping. And when you're understanding that if you can make your children healthier, the whole world will be healthier. They'll be healthier adults. They'll be more productive. We'll be better as a society. That's the part of Sick Kids that I really understood people lived. And you do it child by child, family by family. A friend of mine had a son who was in a serious accident here, and his son was 14, and he was at Sick Kids, and he was being treated by the head of surgery at Sick Kids. So I was, comforting my friend when he was in Emerge, and he said, you know, I had a run-in with the doctor because he was saying to my son Jacob, you know, we're going in to do this surgery. It's possible at the end of it that we'll have to remove some of your toes. I promise we'll do all we can to prevent that happening, but if it does, I also promise you, we'll give you repairs so you'll still be able to play soccer and do the things. And the father said, you know, pulled the doctor aside and said, you know what, I don't like you talking to my son like that, and you're going to scare him, and it's wrong. And the surgeon, who is a friend of mine and brilliant, said, you know what, I'm a parent. I know how sad this is for you and how upsetting and how anxious. He said, but Jacob is my patient. He has to trust that I'm giving him the truth. Mm-hmm. And if he doesn't trust me, this isn't going to work. So I'd like to do what you say because it's easier. He needs to know I'm giving him the straight goods.
Mm-hmm. And what does it say if he doesn't give that information and then ends up, and then Jacob wakes up with missing toes?
That's right.
And then what does that say for Jacob's trust down the road with doctors?
That's right.
Yeah, exactly.
And my friend who had, questioned the doctor about this said, at that point, I knew what made Sick Kids so special. Mm. That in fact, it's the child. It's the child and
that
the
matters.
Relationship there
yeah.
that matters.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was uplifting in ways, and people are hugely hardworking and optimistic and diligent. And sure, there are things that don't work or, are disappointing. And but you just go on because this is the right thing to do and the right way to do it and the right place to do it.
Right. I love that.
It's a privilege to work like that.
Yeah, no kidding.
It really is.
I mean, what a team.
Yeah. And if I look back, I was privileged all the way through to work in great places. I worked at the AGO. I worked at Harborfront. I worked at United Way. Mm. Now I'm working at the ROM. I mean, I love communications when you have something that you care about.
You're getting at all these cool spots in Toronto.
Yeah. Cool spots, yeah. No, yeah.
ROM is so cool.
The ROM is pretty cool.
Yeah. I've only ever been once.
You should go while you're here and see the blue whale. It is.
Oh, we should totally go.
Man.
We went.
Is it open on Sundays?
Oh, yeah.
Brian and I and his twin brother, Dennis, we drove to the Olympics when they were in Vancouver from Halifax.
Oh my God, how amazing.
Oh, so cool. And we stopped here for a night or two on the way through. I think it was just one night. And we woke up in the morning and we went to the ROM. And
the Royal Ontario Museum for anybody
Ontario
who
Ontario Museum, yeah.
And it was so cool. And that, I feel like that was the transition. I mean, that was a very transitional period of my life anyway. But going from museums are lame to museums are the coolest thing in the world.
Yeah.
So
that's
awesome.
That's a pretty sweet, when I made that realization, Night at the Museum, my favorite movie of all time.
But when Ben Stiller's not there, you get really let down.
But the exhibition that's the big exhibition there now with the blue whale it's such a Canadian story.
Yeah,
you know?
No kidding.
And
let's go.
It's the biggest thing you'll ever, I was stunned when I saw it.
How much is it to get in?
$15 or something?
Yeah, something like that.
Guys, let's fucking go on Sunday.
You'll love it.
Sweet.
And it's got the heart is there, which just arrived. And
the heart of the blue whale?
I saw the video of them reeling it in this huge box.
How big is it?
Well, when
dude, it's like bigger than you, man.
Yeah, it's as big as a mini car.
Whoa.
Dude, it's big.
Oh, yeah.
Dude, that's his heart.
I know.
Our heart,
how big
compared to that heart?
I know. It beats a lot.
Like, our heart's a fist. Like, that's your heart,
dude.
And you think the dinosaur's big, and you think this is the biggest.
It's the biggest thing in the world, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think it's supposed to be the biggest thing that's ever lived.
It's the biggest mammal that's ever lived. And it's amazing.
Crazy.
Wow.
So this isn't supposed to be an ad for that, but don't miss it. It's really cool.
Yeah, I'm sure this will actually come out.
www.rom.com.
This episode, Sick Boy, was brought to you by the ROM.
And if you want to contribute and donate, become a member.
There you go.
Judith, you mentioned that you were doing some speaking.
Yes.
What are the topics that you're talking about?
I mostly talk about the patient experience, and I fell into this while I was going through the patch and the treatments. A colleague asked if I'd come and speak at a conference that UHN was having, and it was called The Patient at the Center, and it was the heads of administration, the boards, and the clinical leadership. And, you know, I'm kind of an A-type, and I said, it won't all be good, and she said, fine. I wrote out this presentation when I got there. She said, oh, the agenda's changed, and you're the only patient, and you're at the last 5 minutes of the day. And I got up to speak at the end, and I didn't actually know what I would say because I couldn't deal with my notes. And I said, if I were a cynic, I would say that to have a conference called The Patient at the Center and have one patient at the last moment when all of you have your iPhones out and are ready to get out of here, I'd say you didn't really care. And I said, but I am not a cynic, I'm an optimist, and I think I have the last word. And people put their stuff down and they listened. And and from that, people have asked me to speak about it. And it's my way of giving back. I mean, when I had to leave the sick kids, I had to create a new scaffolding for my life. I mean, I never was ambitious to be earning a zillion dollars, but I loved what I did. Mm. And so when you don't have that, this helped me to stay involved, and it helped me to give back to a system that saved my life over and over again. Mm. You know, so I speak with nurses. I spoke to a nursing group this week. I speak at conferences. I speak. I do training with U of T with some of the medical schools. I mean, it's a really privileged position to be in because I've been inside. I understand the pressures. People in healthcare. I mean, they are dealing with administrative and budgets. And I think, in a way, they have to distance themselves from the emotion of each and every patient and each and every patient family. Mm-hmm. And I've often said, you know, if you build a relationship, you can actually have a much better partnership. I was waiting for an appointment early on in my life as a patient and walked into the waiting room, and I'm a very patient patient. I know they don't call it a waiting room for nothing. So I've got my book, and I'm ready to sit there, but you couldn't get a seat. It was so busy, and people had been waiting since 8 o'clock for their appointments. It was 1 o'clock at that point. And I thought, God, if the two administrators just came out and explained to people that there'd been a delay, we're really sorry. I mean, you've been a patient. All you want to do is be acknowledged. Mm-hmm. You know, your time's valuable too. Mm-hmm. When I finally got in to see the doctor, it was an eye clinic, and it was, you know, you had to read those signs A, B, C, D, E, F on the wall. I was sitting there. It was now I'd been there 5.5 hours, and I was still calm about that. She walked in. She said, read the charge, and she never looked at me, and I said, you know what? We have to start over. And unlike everybody else.
You said that?
I did. I wasn't yelling at her.
Judith.
I said, we have to start over. We have to build a relationship here. I said, so you tell me your name and I'll tell you my name. I don't want to be your best friend. I don't want to go shopping with you. You don't need to talk about your children. But we need to know each other a little bit here.
That's so badass.
Yeah,
and it was because I said it in this tone of voice, and she was so nice and she was so taken aback. I said, I know you've had a horrible pressure cooker day. But don't take it out on me.
Yeah.
And I think all the way through, I was...
And then she quit her job that day. She's like, I'm moving to Cuba. And
no,
like,
she was great. And we had 4 years of a very good relationship.
Get out of here.
Oh, yeah. She was great. She said, oh, my gosh, I'm so sorry. Because it's not that she was mean or unkind.
No.
She was not thinking.
No. Yeah.
And at one point, I was sitting with a doctor, and he was looking at his computer at my brain scans, and they must be pretty damn good because he was really into it. And I finally said to him, you haven't glanced at me. Don't you want to look at the packaging? I mean, it was just, I didn't need to be there. He was just looking at the screen.
Yeah.
And those are the things, those are the reminders that I think you need to get people back to why they get into healthcare.
That's right.
And be a system about people and not about process.
Yeah, just humanizing it.
Yeah,
yeah.
We had an amazing conversation recently with a lady named Fiona who is getting into healthcare, partially because of her experience in living with Addison's disease.
Oh, okay.
And she said something that I found to be really powerful towards the end of our conversation. She said, when I say thank you to my doctor, I'm not saying thank you on behalf of myself. I'm saying thank you on behalf of everyone else in my life who's affected by it and everyone else who has been through it. And I thought that that was so powerful.
That's beautiful.
Because it's not just that one individual who's in the room who's being impacted by this.
And, absolutely.
And when she goes into healthcare, that is what's carrying her into her practice. And I think that your reminder there is something really powerful for those who are in healthcare now and who need to go back to that root and remember why.
It's a beautiful statement that she's made. And actually, if you think about it, it's everything your parents taught you. You know, just treat people the way you would like to be treated. Put yourself in their shoes. And it works both ways. Mm. I mean, we're horrible to some of our healthcare practitioners because our expectation is they will cure us. They'll have the answer. I'll be out of here and my life can continue. And they don't have all the answers. No. And sometimes healthcare is iterative. We'll try this and see if it works. And if it doesn't work, we'll try that. And so
who else in your life do you treat like that? Like nobody.
Nobody. And so I think that it's building that relationship where you kind of understand each other and realize that every single interaction actually counts. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like, okay, I'll be good today and then forget about the niceties of it or the humanity of it or just even look people in the eye or actively listen to them. Mm-hmm. I mean, most MDs, there's research that says you can talk for 26 seconds before you'll be interrupted. And it's not because they're mean people, but they're listening to give you an answer. They're actually not listening to hear what you're saying. Mm. They're not looking at your body language because a lot of times that's more expressive than any words that can come out of your mouth.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot that we can learn just by going back to the basics of why did you go into this? What can we accomplish together? How do we treat each other? You know, Maya Angelou had said it best in a poem years ago. And when I do speak, I use this because I love it. And she said, you know, at the end of the day, people may not remember what you said. They may not even remember what you did, but they will always remember how you made them feel. Mm. And I so believe that in healthcare. Mm. I had a radiation oncologist. He was fantastic. And we'd go in and look at my scans and he'd show me and it was all good. And one day I walked in and he said, oh, I want to talk to you about something first. And I thought, oh, this isn't going to be good. And he said, how's the wedding planning going? Mm-hmm. And it was the most humane thing he could have done for me because it reminded me I'm a person outside of this, you know, environment, the womb of healthcare. And it meant a great deal. So it was just a kind thing to say. Mm-hmm.
And easy, really, like easy to bring up
and not costly and not time consuming, you know, come in and introduce yourself. That's a nice thing to do. Yeah. Huh? And when I go back to the basics, it's like the three A's, you know, acknowledge the patient, ask what they need and act on it. You know, I mean, but acknowledgement is a big deal because when you're a patient, you often feel, well, it was Christopher Hitchens who said, you feel like a cube of sugar being dissolved in a glass.
I love Christopher Hitchens.
I do too. And that to me is actually what happens because you feel, I don't want to be that patient who's too pushy because then they'll treat me differently. I don't want to make a fuss. I shouldn't, I can't. Well, you should be able to ask the questions. And if you don't understand them, you should be able to say, I don't understand.
I don't get it. Mm-hmm.
Help me understand further. And someone should be encouraging you to do that. Because then the whole healthcare partnership works better. Mm-hmm. So,
Judith, what would you say your experience with this brain tumor has taken away from you?
Well, certainly it took me off a career path that I adored, and I'm one of the lucky ones who did adore my career. I appreciate that. It certainly puts, I said it's kind of cloak. Like, I'm aware that the radiation in my brain is not a good thing. Mm. And I know that I'm pretty confident there'll be an ugly outcome from that. So I'm not going to be one of those people to say, boy, it's really good that it happened because I now appreciate every day. I always was good at that. Like, that was called Pollyanna from the time I was six, you know, in a disgusting, like, oh, God, she's singing about the morning again. Right? but I think it does sharpen your perceptions of the world. You know, and I get impatient with people who have a hangnail and think it's the worst thing that ever happened or that don't understand all that they have I mean, 99% of the world would look at the way we live in Canada and could say, oh my God, what a blessing. Mm. And we can be so negative. And so I think it's taught me a lot about that. And also a sense that there are going to be good days, there are going to be bad days. I have headaches almost all the time. And sometimes I can push them back better than others, but it's not the burden that's going to define me. And I think once you let your health define you, that's limiting.
Well, my second question was going to be, what has it given you? But I think you kind of summed it up there.
Yeah. No, I felt disconnected in a way I hadn't anticipated. I'm old enough to have thought about retirement. I'm 66. I should have been thinking that. This happened when I was 60. But I hadn't thought of that. And so when you can plan for it, it's a different experience to say, I want to leave work and I want to do this. I didn't want to leave work and I didn't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been fortunate to be able to build something that's a nice fabric of interesting opportunities and meeting good people and sharing whatever experience I have that might be helpful.
Yeah. Well, thank you for coming in here today and sharing your experience.
Yeah, thank you.
And I haven't even burdened you with the pictures of my new grandson.
Oh, I'd love to see them after. Yeah. I was going to say, actually, I think you might be the oldest guest we've had on the show.
I know.
Which is amazing. It's so refreshing because we oftentimes are sitting down with people kind of similar to our age or younger. And we live in our guests are generally people who listen to podcasts and who are frequenting like that sort of, you know, it's the 20, like 1 to 35 year old range really.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, my parents wouldn't have known what a podcast was until I told them I'm making a podcast now I had to teach them how to do it. And so
remember, they taught you to use a fork.
That's right. That's right. No, totally. Absolutely. Patient. Yep. That is, but so we don't really get the opportunity to speak to people that are a bit older than us. And it's really nice.
Well, I remember when I turned 65 and someone said, oh my God, you must be so depressed. I said, are you kidding?
Oh, yeah.
I made it. Holy cow.
I can't wait to turn 30. I cannot wait.
But I just want to say, Jeremy told Taylor and I before he saw a picture of you and he said, I think Judith is 45.
Oh, I love you more. <I'm so sorry.
laughs> When you said 66, I was like, holy shit.
I look in the mirror and say, who is that woman? I'm glad she's there, I guess.
he said, she's a little bit older than us. I think she's about 45.
Oh, my God. Keep that in the podcast. Don't edit that out.
Again, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Yeah, and thank you for asking me. It's fun.
It was really fun. And thank you all so much for listening. As always, next week, we'll be back with another fascinating, fun episode. In the meantime, head on over to iTunes, subscribe, rate, and review. It's super massively important. We say it every single episode, but like, it really does make a huge difference.
Because if it didn't, we wouldn't say it.
That's right. we're also, be sure to follow us. You know, if everybody who listened to us was also following us on social media, like Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
You'd all love us. Cool. You'd all love us more.
All of you would be able to see all of the cool shit that we're posting on
and
there.
And super, super silly.
Yeah.
And the last and final thing I want to add into that is that if you're like driving in a car somewhere, you're doing some mundane task while you're listening to this, the next interaction you have with a human being, just tell them about Sick Boy Podcast.
Hey, there you go.
Well, yeah, exactly. Nice one, it's like a pay it forward type deal.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. Going over to www. You don't have to do www. That's not a thing anymore.
Who does that?
Patreon.com/sickboy. That's a little crowdfunding thing that we do. It's like it's kind of like Kickstarter, except it's a monthly thing. So you sign up to do X amount of a contribution each and every month, and we do a lot of cool exclusive content. All of our live shows go up on there, so they're exclusive.
First dibs on tickets
to live shows. You get a discount, 10% discount on all of our merch. So go over on to sickboy.com, go to the sickboypodcast.com and go to the shop page of our website. We got tons of merch over there.
The other thing is that on our Patreon is that we're doing really well on there. And everyone who's supported us so far, we thank you so much. And our conversation with Judith today wouldn't have happened.
Brought to you by Patreon.
It literally is brought to you by our supporters. It's what gives us the ability to fly to Toronto and talk to really rad people. So thank you all so much for that. I think that's it for today.
Yeah. I'm Brian.
I'm Taylor.
And I'm Jeremy. And this is Sick Boy.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.